Crazy Buddhist, a conversation about Buddhist ideas, Buddhist teaching, Buddhism in the real world with Reverend Jerry Hirano, the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah. We'll hear today about where the crazy Buddhist concept comes from, but we'll explore a lot of other ideas in a free-ranging conversation, including some thoughts from a young person who's been exploring Buddhist ideas. I'm Dan Bomas. Delighted you could join us today. Jerry, why don't you explain to us where the idea of crazy Buddhist came from and what it is you're trying to do here?
Well, the original idea came from a letter I received for someone asking me what I thought about how Buddhism should address mental health and if they should take medications if they're Buddhists, trying to imply that just by being Buddhist is medication enough. So I asked my wife, Carmela, who's a psychiatrist, about this. And we started talking, and we both came, because she's also ordained. We said, Buddhism doesn't try to keep you from going crazy. It's to accept yourself as you are. So there's no problem with being crazy and still being Buddhist. So we thought, well, that's a good title for something. We should discuss these issues that people have mixed up about that.
Well, when you first mentioned it to me, it seemed to me as though it would be outside the standard way that Buddhism is normally presented, which is kind of a scholarly, here's this religious tradition that Westerners have adopted from the East, and it has all these important ideas in it, and that you have to understand what it's doing and practice the way it's prescribed. And one of the attractive features about Jodo Shinshu, or Pure Land Buddhism, is that you don't really require that. You don't have to do all that stuff.
No. Jodo Shinshu is very much focused on the common person, the lay person, whereas many of the other schools of Buddhism, you had to be, at least Japanese Buddhist, you had to have time, you had to have the inclination to put in a lot of effort. And the reason Jodo Shinshu became big is because it focused on the peasants, which it wasn't before. It was Buddhism was patronized by rich samurai who had time to do things.
Well, even in Zen, there's two branches, Soto Zen and Rinzai Zen. One is supposedly warrior Zen, and the other is farmer Zen.
Well, kind of, because Soto Zen, Dogen, is actually a contemporary of our founder, Shindan, and he focused on just sitting. It's called Shikantaza. Whereas the Rinzai Zen, while you're sitting, you have to focus on these various koans and riddles, right? So I guess you would be more educated, but both Soto and Rinzai, I think Zen has more of a attribution towards samurai than Jodo Shinshu does. Jodo Shinshu is a very peasant, lay-oriented Buddhism, although the head of our sect, who's a patrilineal line from Shindan, they're somehow now married into the royal family. So they are very high samurai, but the actual followers, it's mostly the farmers who became part of it.
Why does it take that approach, and why is it different?
Well, I'll give you like Zen. You sit, and if you're a farmer, you got to go out and work in the fields from early morning to later, just like in the West. They didn't have time to sit. So this aspect of Buddhism that wasn't emphasized a lot, which is just say the Nembutsu, Namu Amida Butsu, that's all you have to do, is what Jodo Shinshu did. And so Jodo Shinshu, another good way you could see this, Jodo Shinshu is often attributed as the reason the feudal system in Japan was broken down. Because once the peasants realized that they were okay just as they were, they had this freedom they felt to to go out and not want to be set into these statuses.
And Japan had a very rigid social order.
Oh, very much so. There was the samurai, then with the main classes were samurai, then farmers, then merchants, and then there's what's called the barakumin or outcasts. And they don't even talk about that too much. And being a Japanese American, I used to think, well, I'm so happy. I'm from the lowest caste. I thought, I'm not barakumin, but I thought my family was merchants. Until a few years ago, I have relatives from Japan, and one of them is a Japanese history teacher. And he goes, we're not merchants. Hiranos have been samurai and he gave me my genealogy to the 1500s. I said, I was kind of disappointed that I wasn't from the lower caste. We were from the samurai caste.
And not something that Americans, and you are as American as you are Japanese.
Right, right.
Not something that we think a whole lot about.
Right. It's very different. Like when you watch, I like British TV and like Korean TV, I see how status is such a big part of it. And that's so different than growing up in the United States. It's not about the class you're born into so much.
Well, I think some, and particularly young people, would be surprised that there's more than one kind of Buddhism. I mean, they're used to, you know, Presbyterians and Jehovah's Witnesses and Latter-day Saints, you know, different flavors of
right.
Christian religion, but not at all realizing that there are significant differences in Buddhist sects.
So, yeah, Buddhism has just as many as Christianity has different varieties. And like most of them were for people who became monks or nuns. You had to live in a monastery away. So it was when Jodo Shinshu broke out and says, you don't have to do that. When Jodo Shinshu more or less came to the common people.
So... that in itself would be seen as crazy by, I guess, someone who's, you know, insisting on a rigid observance of Buddhist teaching. The idea that someone who, like a farmer, a peasant, is probably illiterate, couldn't
right.
read or study these ideas at all, but simply took the opportunity to learn and meet with other people and then... recited what amounts to a mantra
right.
that summarizes their practice.
Right.
Jodo Shinshu Buddhists say, Namo Amida Butsu. What does that mean?
It means to take refuge in the Buddha Amida, who is the Buddha of wisdom and compassion. And so that was all they had to do, which was, you know, the old guard, so to speak, hated that. Because people would pay for merits and things like that the monks would do. And here's this guy saying, you don't got to do that. So the Jodo Shinshu movement was very heavily outlawed at first.
But today it's the largest single Buddhist
right.
group in Japan, right?
Right, yes.
And it's also seen by... Americans is kind of an ethnocentric religion. It's a Japanese-specific kind of religion, or it has been in this country, even though there are versions of it in China and other places. But why did it become so popular and widespread in Japan?
As I said, it wasn't Shindan so much, but his eighth descendant, Karenyo, who really began to emphasize these teachings to, one, women, right? And then he would go out to where these poorer people are. And so that really made it a large, popular form of Buddhism. And then when the immigration to the U.S. started, most of them who came were farmers. That level, mostly from Hiroshima, southern Japan, where Jodo Shinshu is like the LDS churches here in Salt Lake. You know, how so many people just kind of automatically associate, if you're from Utah, you must be Mormon. In Japan, it was almost, if you're from Hiroshima, you must be Jodo Shinshu Buddhist. So that's why in the U.S., we're the oldest Buddhist school here, because we came with the immigration.
But not widely accepted until recently outside the Japanese ethnic community, for reasons that I guess we can get into later. But when you talk about Amida Buddha, the question comes up, you mean there's more than one?
Right.
Who is this Buddha guy?
So in Buddhism, just like in Christianity, I was fascinated when I first heard that Christian people describe the Trinity in terms of an egg, right? About the Father, Son, Holy Ghost is like the outer white, the shell, then the white part, and then the yolk. And when I was in Japan, I also heard that explanation for the various Buddhas. And then they also use the concept of ice, of steam, water, and ice. So the solid piece of ice would be the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, who was a prince in Japan about 2,600 years ago.
In Japan or India?
Oh, India, yeah. Who we first call Shakyamuni Buddha, the sage of the Shakya clan. Right? Then you have the cosmic Buddha, and that's where Amida, Vairocana, a number of other Buddhas are more, I guess you would say, in a heavenly area. They're not physical beings here. And then there's what's called the Dharmakaya, which is the essence of truth itself. So there's these three forms, and there's many, many, many Buddhas. Siddhartha Gautama always said he wasn't the first Buddha. He was the rediscoverer of Buddha, of the Buddhist teachings for this age.
But I have here in my hand a bottle that once contained Lucky Buddha beer, empty at this point, sorry. And it has a figure on it that many people describe as Buddha, but it's actually not.
Right. It's in Japanese, he's called Hotte. In Chinese, he's called Budai. And he's not really, in Japan, he's one of the seven lucky gods. But originally, if you go back historically to who this fat guy with a little, he always carries a cloth. He's wearing monk's robes, usually bald-headed and laughing. The legend goes back to a Chinese Zen monk by the name of Budai. And that's how that started. But he's associated with good fortune. And he himself, it was said that there's some things that say that he left a message when he died that said he was actually the Buddha, the Bodhisattva Maitreya, who is considered the future Buddha, the next Buddha.
Bodhisattva.
Right.
What does that word mean?
Bodhisattva is someone who gives up their own personal enlightenment or going just into nirvana to make sure that everybody else comes along with him. It's the essence of Buddhism. If you say there's two schools, main schools of Buddhism, Theravada, which are the monks that you see in the saffron robes from mostly Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, and then Mahayana, which is really developed in China, Japan, Korea. Mahayana means the larger vehicle, which means the vehicle takes everybody to enlightenment, whereas Theravada is really to gain enlightenment for yourself.
All right, and they have different sets of scriptures, languages, in fact, the scriptures are written in.
Well, the main language that is used now, the tradition would be classical Chinese, and it's called the Tripitaka. It's about 100 volumes, and the Tripitaka means three baskets. It's the dharmas, the vinayas, was the sutras, the vinayas, and Abhidharma, which are the commentaries. And so each sect of Buddhism, because it's so large, the whole idea, they select certain sutras for their own religion. For instance, Jodo Shinshu, we have three sutras from the Tripitaka that we focus, and that's where the story of Amida Buddha comes from.
And from the Southeast Asian version of Buddhist scriptures is where the biographical information about Buddha comes from, and a lot of the teachings from when he was alive.
Right, right. And then like Zen, or the biggest school here in the United States right now is a very new form of Buddhism called Soko Gakkai. And they're in some way similar to Jodo Shinshu, and they focus on one thing. We say Namo Amida Butsu, which means I take refuge in Amida Buddha. They say Namyo Horen Gekkyo, which means I take refuge in the Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra is one of those sutras from the Tripitaka that I'm talking about.
Most famous adherent of Soka Gakkai is Tina Turner.
Right, Tina Turner, yeah.
But
Herbie
certainly
Hancock
not,
too.
Okay, but certainly not the only ones.
No, there's quite a few famous people now who are in that.
When people find out that you are a minister of a Buddhist church, it would seem that they'd have one of two reactions. One is, okay, cool. And the other is, wow, tell me more.
Right.
Is that what you discover?
Yeah, well, it's the story on that. I think I might have told you that I had died in a hospital in Reno from this sudden bleed out. And when I came to, I was in ICU with all these tubes hooked up to me. I didn't know what was going on. And this nurse is there, and she smiles, and she says, oh, you're awake. And then she asked me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a Buddhist priest. She goes, oh, how interesting. I've always wanted to know about Buddhism. Could you tell me about it? And I'm thinking
you
in my head.
You're kind of preoccupied.
I says, yeah, I'm dying here, and you want me to tell you about Buddhism? So I just told her what I think was an important thing, which is the idea of impermanence. I said, I know this is a bad situation, but this is also impermanent, but it teaches me to be a lot more grateful for the things that also are impermanent.
Well, impermanence is one of those teachings that is common to every sect of Buddhism. And there are others. The Four Noble Truths is where a lot of people start. One reason for that, I guess, is because in the stories, it's the first teaching that Buddha offered to the world after his enlightenment.
Exactly. It's Four Noble Truths are foundational for every sect of Buddhism. The idea that life is suffering. You know, we use that word suffering as a translation of dukkha, but my friends who are much more capable in the etymology, they said it means more of a dissatisfaction, dukkha. So they described it as a not fully balanced axle on a cart. So it makes things bumpy. It doesn't go as you want. And that's what dukkha is. That's the first noble truth. Then it goes to tanha, which is the reason for this. And then third is the way you could get out. And fourth is actually the way, which is called the Eightfold Path, right? Views, thoughts, speech, conduct, effort, livelihood, mindfulness, and meditation.
When I first learned this, I was looking at the Four Noble Truths, and I said, but what's the fourth one? It doesn't say what the fourth one is, until I realized the fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path.
Exactly.
But the second noble truth has appealed to me because it explains the suffering. It basically, our suffering is caused by our inability to let go of the things that make us suffer.
Right. The word is uses tanha, which some have translated as desire, but I think of it more as ego. It's our ego self. And that's why, in my view, I don't think that as a human being right now, where I'm at, I could totally get away with getting rid of my ego. So I don't think that I can become enlightened in this world, so to speak. But I can try to control it. I can realize that my ego is causing me so much suffering, you know? And so instead of being so egotistical, try to think more of how can I be of service? How can I benefit others? I think that's a key.
And the third noble truth is the amazing promise made by the Buddha, which is that your suffering can have an end.
Right. And that if you can see what this ego is doing to you in your own desire, then you can find a way to get out of it. And that moves into that fourth noble truth of this is the way. The problem is, when we talk about these things like right view, right thought, just beginning with view is important. It's saying to have perfect right view. And I wonder how many of us can do that, you know, to see the world as it is rather than the way in our mind we think it should be.
I told my younger son once that our suffering begins when we believe the story that we tell about ourselves.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
And what you're saying is that right view has to lead you past that story.
Right. And so like Zen Buddhists, a lot of times they talk about when they're sitting in meditation, the thing that they have to realize, if you sit in meditation, anyone could just sit, say 30 seconds, a minute, in quiet contemplation. There's a voice that's talking in your head. Someone is talking to you saying, this hurts, or why am I doing this stupid thing, right? To realize you're not that voice. That voice is not you. That controlling voice in your head is not who you really are. You're a bunch of different elements that come together for a moment, but then will pass. So we just have to be able to see, gain perspective on that.
So, yeah, we've covered a lot of territory, like, you know, who's the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, and all of these topics have in-depth inquiry that can go for, you know, the subject for years. But for somebody who's first starting out and first starting to learn about Buddhism, the first thing you learn is that it's all the cool kids do it. But then, how do you find out more, and how do you know that what you're being taught is not garbage?
I think that you really have to look at who's teaching you. And there's so many places to go for teaching now, especially with the internet. But try to make sure that your teacher had authentic teachers. And for instance, in Zen, that's why in Zen they usually talk about their line all the time. So you know who that particular teacher comes from. Within my school of Buddhism, Jodo Shinshu, it's kind of a, you would say, academic kind of thing. So where did your teacher go to school? What was his educational background? And then you could find so much on the internet now. But just, I want to make one comment since you brought it up. The cool kids are Buddhists. It's one of the also reasons why I thought it's important to have a podcast that anyone could hear is my daughter. She went to school here in Bountiful and she came home once and she goes, I just hate the way everyone thinks of me when I tell them I'm Buddhist. And I thought she was being discriminated against. Like me, when I grew up, there weren't no Buddhists around really in Salt Lake, you know. So when they found out I was Buddhist, it was like, oh my gosh, you're like a devil worshiper. But for my daughter, I go, oh yeah, you know, racism or discrimination is just part of life. She goes, no, Dad, that's not it. I go, then what's the problem? She goes, when I tell them I'm Buddhist, they go, "That's so cool." And I go, "What's wrong with that?" She goes, "I don't want to be that so cool. I want to be just like them so that they know that being Buddhist isn't strange. It's just what my religion is, you know." But anyway, yeah, there's a number of places you can find very good teachers. Salt Lake, well, in Utah, we have so many temples now that we didn't when I was growing up.
Well, the temple where you're the minister is the Salt Lake Buddhist Church on the corner of First South and West Temple, right?
Second
West in First South. But there are lots of other places. There's a Zen, what do you call a Zendo,
right.
A place where you can learn that tradition. But there are also various flavors of New Agey teaching that are out there that kind of incorporate some Buddhist ideas along with, I don't know what else, some Native American cultural appropriation or other teachings. So how do you know? Well, the Dalai Lama, when he was here 20 years ago, recommended that people practice in an authentic tradition. And that's what you're saying.
Right.
How do you tell, again, if that tradition is authentic, and how do you even get through the front door if, you know, do people walk through the door of your church and say, "I want to learn"?
Yeah. The thing is, some temples, we meet on Sundays, usually. But we have a website and we have study classes, we have meditation groups. But most temples, if you just go to them, they'll welcome you. Like, I have assistants whose one job is, if someone walks into the temple that looks like they're a little bit lost, that assistant is to come up to them, welcome them, explain what's going on, tell them, you know, exactly what's happening in the service. So they're welcome. And I found that at most Buddhist temples are like that.
Well, you've said, too, that the two things that Jodo Shinshu Buddhists do is they chant and they eat.
Right. That's what I've
been less eating recently during the pandemic. Right. And I don't know if you're even having meetings indoors at this point.
No.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Jodo Shinshu service is going to involve some chanting.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, chanting for us is like Christians singing. In Christianity, the purpose of hymns and singing is to praise God. In the Jodo Shinshu tradition, the whole chanting tradition, our tradition comes from Tendai, another form of Buddhism, but it's to praise the virtues of Buddha. And then we do that we chant in classical Chinese. And there are translations, but I say chanting in a traditional way is different than understanding it. It says, I'll have study classes where we go through the sutras line by line, talk about what is being said. But when we chant, if you know too much exactly what you're saying, your mind gets confused. It's like I have always used the explanation that the conservative Jews did. They tried to switch from Hebrew to English for a while. They went back to Hebrew because they said that it became that their members are arguing with the Torah in their head. And it's the same thing with chanting.
Which is a great thing. It's what you do in Judaism, but you don't necessarily do it in the middle of the service.
Right. It's taking away the whole purpose of expressing appreciation, the idea of gratitude. And so in the sutras, some of the sutras example I use is, they talk about the lion's roar of the Buddha's teaching, or the steadfast nature, like an elephant's walk. I said, for me, if I hear lions, I hear elephants, I think of the circus, then my mind goes to, oh, when I was a kid, I went to the circus. I don't like clowns. I'm no longer expressing appreciation. So it gets away from the purpose.
And you do provide a document to work from.
Yes, yes. Everything is written out. So like I said, we're doing our services online. So they're PDF copies that all the members have. So as I chant, they chant with me. using their people. Well, hopefully they're chanting. I don't know, because it's not on Zoom. We're just doing it on a Facebook Live.
So. Mm-hmm. And they find that at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple Facebook page?
Yes, yes. Okay. Also, just to mention, there are a lot of talks also. I'm also the director of what's called the Center for Buddhist Education, which is our national organization, Buddhist Churches of America. And there are a lot of online YouTube lectures, if they're interested in that.
We'll shift the conversation for a few minutes to include Teresa Maloney. Teresa grew up in Bountiful, Utah, became interested in Buddhism as a teenager. She recently spent some time in California with an aunt who has a PhD in Buddhist studies and had some deep conversations that piqued her interest. In your conversations with her, did anything come up that you thought was either really worthwhile or completely ridiculous? Or
most of our conversations that I had because of my wants from Buddhism came around death, psychedelic use, Ram Dass, you know, Robert Alpert, and more Alan Watts philosophy on Zen, and that led me to more Mahayana Buddhism. I guess my biggest question is, what is the biggest theological difference between Theravada and Mahayana?
We had talked a little bit about that before, but I think the big change happened when people went beyond just the Theravada tradition of being a monk and following the exact way of the historical Buddha, and it became more concerned of what does Buddhism do for society as a whole. And that's when Mahayana began to develop, and the whole idea of we mentioned the bodhisattva, but the idea of a bodhisattva ideal is when Mahayana came in, when it was more concerned of how do all of us get to enlightenment and just not the individual practitioner who's a monk.
Okay. And Jodo Shinshu is part of the Mahayana tradition.
Yes, yes.
You also, I think, had a question some time ago about mantras. And a mantra is a phrase that you chant. It's typically not in English. But Namu Amida Butsu is a mantra?
In some sense. And it's an interesting thing because I have a friend he was quite high as a Tibetan monk, but now he's a Jodo Shinshu Buddhist. And Tibetan Buddhism talks a lot about sound. The power in the sound, the power in the words. So when he talks, Jodo Shinshu usually doesn't do that, but he said Namu Amida Butsu has all this power because people have said, why do you have to say Namu Amida Butsu? It's just a metaphor for something else and it just means this. And his explanation is there is power just in saying that. In the Nembutsu, Namu Amida Butsu. And if you talk about it that way, then it is a mantra.
But a lot of people have heard Om Mani Padme Hung, which is from a Buddhist scripture called the Lotus Sutra, right?
Right. Well, I think it's Pali, but it could be from the Lotus. But Lotus also is, like I told you, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, which Soko Gakkai focuses on. So Lotus is a very major sutra.
And another famous sutra, I guess, is the Heart Sutra.
Right.
Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, what's the rest of it? Parasamgate, bodhisvaha.
All sects of Buddhism use the Heart Sutra except Jodo Shinshu. And I can't get a reason why they don't. But so here in America, I know a lot of my friends who are also Jodo Shinshu priests, they sometimes will chant it. Because they like it. And it's also the shortest of all the sutras.
Right. Like the Lotus Sutra wasn't even available in English until recently.
Right. Most of them. When I grew up, most of them weren't in English or they're in terrible English. But now it's quite good.
Mm-hmm. So if depending on your level of commitment to study.
Right. When I was starting, you know, my studies as a priest 40-something years ago, if you really wanted to be a PhD in Buddhist studies and you went to some of the traditional Buddhist universities in the United States, such as Harvard, Stanford, UC Berkeley, you had to be able to do one of the Asian languages, usually Chinese or Japanese, and then Sanskrit. So you had to be pretty fluent in those languages. Luckily for me, I'm not a scholar. So I had, well, but when I became a priest, I had to learn Japanese.
And you were ordained in Japan.
Right, right. And I went to school in Japan besides Berkeley. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do your friends tell you about Buddhism? Or do you ever discuss this with them? I mean, you're at a relatively higher level of understanding than many young people. What do they think about Buddhism and your interest in that?
Most of my friends don't really know much other than what they teach you in like basic geography classes about what religions are in what places of the world. A lot of people that I talk to do not get very far in depth. But I do believe there's some kind of universal selection. So I'm around people who are actively involved. People are polarized to me that are like-minded. So for example, last night when I was hanging out at the bar with a couple of friends, we were all joking about something about Christianity and Mormonism, and I brought up The Art of Living and Dying, and all of them had no idea what that was. And I was like, yeah, there's an entire cycle of how you can go through death or rebirth in these like systems. All of them were just sitting there like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, that's excellent books, and even Pema Chodron, who's a Buddhist nun and teacher, has a whole series of teachings on that particular issue as well. Many places that you can go
right to
learn more about that.
I do think nowadays a lot more people that I do get involved with, for example, Seth and a bunch of my friends in that realm, more the party realm of Utah that I've met, they're really interested in Timothy Leary's work. That's really how I got started. I mean, other than Dan introducing me to Buddhism at like 16, that the Bardo system of the choosing to rebirth your mind, people love working on themselves right now. I think so many people want to better themselves. They want to better their lives. And like you were saying, we don't have to be monks to do it anymore. So as far as I have been aware, it's really interesting to see how people, I don't know, it's multifaceted.
I think there's a huge change in society as a whole. Mm-hmm. As far as looking at Buddhism, like, I wasn't joking when I said when I was young here in Salt Lake and I said I was Buddhist, it was like, oh, you got to be an idol worshiper, mm-hmm. you know, or what is that? Or else it was Kung Fu, the TV show with David Carradine. They think, you know, we're like that. But now most people know about, Zen, or the Dalai Lama is a superstar in the West, right? He's a cultural icon. Mm-hmm. So people are much more familiar, you know. So that's why I was just telling Dan earlier, my daughter, when she was going to school in Bountiful, she didn't like it because as soon as she said she was Buddhist, everyone go, oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. And she said, that doesn't make me cool. Mm-hmm. It's just my religion.
Yeah, you know? I just am.
Well, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes. There's a term I haven't used yet, but it's sensei, which is your title. It means teacher. Mm-hmm. And Korean, it's sunsang, sunsang nim, honorable teacher. And it's great to sit with you for a few minutes. And we'd love to do this again, especially include some other voices in the conversation.
Great. That'll be fun.
Jerry Hirano is the minister at the Salt Lake Buddhist Temple in Salt Lake City, Utah. He was born and grew up in Utah, where his father was also a minister. His education includes degrees from the University of Utah and the Institute of Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, California, as well as advanced training and ordination at the Central Buddhist Institute in Kyoto, Japan. He's married to Carmela Havayana Hirano, who is also an ordained Jodo Shinshu priest, as well as a doctor specializing in psychiatry. I'm Dan Bomas, and we're grateful you've taken the time to listen to Crazy Buddhist. Please leave us a rating or a review. We'll be back in a month or so.